welcome to another episode of Great People TV with me, Ben Ibrahim. And tonight I'm flying solo. Why am I flying solo? Because tonight is a Top Gun special where we're talking about the movie and we are going to be interviewing a very special person to see how accurate the movie is. As you can see from the poster this week, the real Top Gun is the name of the topic. But before we talk all things Top Gun tonight, please don't forget to like and support Great People TV, our YouTube, our Facebook, our LinkedIn, and our Instagram. So before I welcome our real Top Gun pilot on our show tonight, let me tell you a little bit about her. Yes, she's a real female extraordinaire. Lieutenant Commander Ashley Pelzik, who is a real Top Gun pilot, is our guest tonight. She's a qualified strike fighter tactics instructor and a Top Gun graduate. She is a trained weapon system officer, also known as Wizzo, and that means she sat behind the Mavericks of this world to strategize how to win the battles in the air. She served in the United States Navy for 11 years. She's also an academic rock star because she graduated from MIT with an MBA, and she now runs a very successful startup called Merlin Labs. And here's the oxymoron: Merlin Labs is designing a technology that will fly the plane without a human being. So without further ado, please welcome Miss Ashley Pelzik, also a very, very talented basketball player and all-around leader. Ashley, or Ash, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Ben. Thanks for having me here today.
Oh, you have a very, very impressive CV, and thank you for coming on our show. But let's talk about Top Gun. And how many times have you seen Top Gun 3 before? I mean, Top Gun 2, sorry, before we start our discussion?
I know, you got me excited there about a third one. So I've seen the movie three times. I went to the premiere back in early May. They had a special release at North Island for, you know, some of the naval aviators that worked on the movie and then some other guests. So I was very fortunate to be invited to that. So I got to see it, you know, a few weeks ahead of everyone else. And then I had to just live in my own excitement for a few weeks while everybody else caught up and finally got to see it. Then I went to see it with my parents because, you know, that was something my dad and I were really into. Is when I was really young, we watched the first one all the time. So we had to go see the second one together in the IMAX, which is how I recommend you see it. And then I went again with my niece and nephew on a rainy day a few weekends ago. So safe to say I really loved it.
No. Now let's talk about what you just said, really loving it. Because, I mean, once we got connected and you're really a friendly person and, you know, you told me the story on the phone or on video that you became a naval aviator because you fell in love with the movie Top Gun 1 when the movie came out in 1986 with Tom Cruise and Anthony Edwards. And that was around that you were 10 years old. You watched it probably in 1992, 1994. So you got inspired by Top Gun and you applied for Top Gun because you saw the movie. So when you graduated, when you got into Top Gun, which is really, really hard, by the way, like, what was the expectation? Like, did you say when you were working there, studying there, did you say, wow, this is the real thing? Or, oh my God, this is the movie is so far from the truth. Which one was it?
I'd say it's somewhere in the middle. I think, you know, my path to Top Gun was not necessarily direct. I really loved the movie as a kid. I was actually obsessed with the video game, even just listening to the opening. It has the opening soundtrack when you let the video game play on the Nintendo, which dates me a bit. But my dad used to catch me sneaking downstairs late at night just to play it and just to hear it. And then, you know, I got into, you know, did the standard kid thing. I played sports. I got in high school. I didn't really think too much about it. I wasn't that one that just saw it once and then that's all I ever wanted to do in life. I was very fortunate that, you know, I ended up at the Naval Academy, and while I was there, sort of realized, hey, there's really nothing else I want to do here other than fly. And so my path, again, had a few different turns along the way. But once I got there, you know, I think there's a little bit of mixed feelings going into it. You know, it's a really, really difficult course, and you know that because the people that train you for it have given you, you know, all of the guidance, and they've taught you all of the tactics you'll need to learn and how to teach. But, you know, it's up to you. It's one of the few, I'd say, true meritocracies, where you either do well and you're either really good in the aircraft and you're good at teaching, or you don't. And so it's up to you how well you do. And the parts that are realistic, I mean, the flying is incredibly intense. I think the second movie, if anything, captures that. The bonds are very, you know, very, very well formed. We didn't have any competitions. There's no first place trophy or anything like that. And we don't have classes outside in the hangar, unfortunately. It's all in very secure places and deep, dark rooms. But we studied a lot. You know, we did have some fun. You know, we went to Pensacola for my BFM detachment, because they try to move that around every year and have it in different places for each class. And we did actually play beach volleyball more as a joke than anything. But I would say we were really heads down studying from 5 a.m. until 9 p.m. most nights, and then, you know, maybe one day off a week. So it was pretty intense. And the whole time you're there, you never say, oh, this is easy, I'm definitely going to pass this course. You know, there's a dip for some, the course is challenging at different points for everybody. Some people struggle in the beginning, and some people struggle at the end, and some people just sort of barely get by. But, you know, if you graduate, you feel pretty good about yourself, because they don't, you know, they don't hold back on phasing people out if they can't handle it.
No. That's really, really cool that what you just said. But tell us about the egos in Top Gun when you were there, because one thing that was said a lot in the movie is that you are the best of the best. You are the best of the best. And Tom Cruise actually said in Top Gun 2, they've been told that their whole life. Is that part true in the Top Gun culture?
Yes and no. I think the Top Gun culture has gone in waves, and I can only speak to the last 15 to 20 years or so, you know, really 15 of what I witnessed. But I actually do think their focus is mainly on humility and being a good teacher. And because those two things go hand in hand, if you're a young aviator and the person teaching you is, you know, very, very, you know, a huge egomaniac, and they're just kind of a jerk, you're not going to learn very well from a person like that. And I think that the instructor cadre itself has gone through some different changes over time, to where for the most part they focused on having, you know, really well-rounded people, which is great. It doesn't mean the occasional person doesn't come through who's pretty cocky. That thing sort of happens, but it's certainly not the case where, I think there's a scene in the second one where they're all meeting at the beginning at the bar at the hard deck, and you know, I think Monica Barbaro's character, Phoenix, she says something like, oh, we're the best of the best. Who are they going to get to teach us? I can't imagine any of my friends saying that, or fellow graduates, but it's good for the movie for sure.
Definitely. That's a bit of Hollywood fiction right there. But in terms of, tell us about also, I keep starting the conversation by saying, tell us, because I mean, you've lived the Need for Speed life, and tell us about the industry respect, like how the Navy would see the movie, like, because like a lot of it, let's be honest, I mean, most of us who are quite used to Hollywood and all that would watch and say, is that really real? Can those moves like above the mountains and all that can be done? Did they like going through the valley in like, I don't know how, I think it was 2 minutes or something like that. Is that possible? Is that realistic? So I'm sure you get this question asked all the time. So can you tell us about the realism or the authenticness of both Top Guns, really?
I think they did a very good job of fitting in a somewhat believable plot into what we could actually do and making it entertaining. And I think, so the first one, I mean, the movies are so different. There's a lot of parallels to be drawn between the two, but they're very different. In terms of what the mission is, right? The first one is essentially what we would call a defensive counter air mission, where you're going out there, you're protecting the aircraft carrier from any impending aircraft that are going to go out. So the first one was very air to air focused. It was very dogfight centric. They talk about that a lot. Whereas the second one, I would say, and you know, the first one obviously featured the Tomcat, the F-14. The second one, you know, the Navy has now transitioned mostly to the F-18 Super Hornet. And so they had to find a mission that made sense for that aircraft. And what they call the F-18 is sort of a Swiss Army knife, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. We can do air to ground or air to surface bombing missions. We can fight air to air. We can do maritime missions. We're a refueling platform. You know, it's a pretty crazy aircraft when you think about all the things it can do. Now, is it the first choice aircraft in any single one of those individual missions? Maybe not. You know, is it the, can it carry the loadout that a F-15 Strike Eagle can, that doesn't have to land on an aircraft carrier? Because you have to consider the loadout. If you were to, you know, not drop any of your weapons, then you have to come back aboard. So you have weight limitations. You know, air to air, I mean, you've got all these fifth gen fighters. They talk about it nonstop in the movie, but you've got F-35s, F-22s. You know, would we be the superior air to air platform? Probably not. And then just generally the surface to air, when they're fighting, coming off the target and, going through their surface to air counter tactics, that's pretty entertaining. I mean, if an aircraft or a pilot could evade all of those missiles, I'd be pretty impressed by that person. But yeah, I think when you bring it all together, though, it sort of is where it makes the most sense. And again, it's a stretch, but it's cool. And it was really cool seeing an aircraft I loved flying, featured so prominently in a movie that, billions of people are seeing worldwide. And it's brought a lot of excitement back. I think we were kind of, when we were growing up in the Top Gun culture, even in our Navy careers, you're discouraged a little bit from talking about the movie. It's a little cheesy. But now that it's come back around, I've seen all of my old bosses, all of my old colleagues, everyone is just wearing their flight suits to the theater. I mean, everyone's excited. That's why we all did it. So it's definitely been effective in that regard. So.
No, that's really, really cool, and it's really good to see that, all due respect, that a lot of the cheesiness of the Hollywood is quashed out in reality, in your professional life when you were in the Navy. Because I've interviewed Navy SEALs before and martial artists, and they say exactly the same thing. What you see on the movies is just movies. It's just one clip. So that's basically it. But now, when you were at Top Gun, and then you graduated from Top Gun, you became a WISO, Weapon System Officer. And there was a bit of a highlight in Top Gun 2 about a guy called Bob, who was the WISO. And a WISO sounds really, really cool on one end, but it sounds really, really unglamorous on the other end, because you are the actual brains trying to work out the dogfight while the Mavericks of this world is taking the glory and taking the shots. So can you explain in very simple terms, the difference between the Maverick, the pilot, and the WISO, and how it all comes together?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I like the way you put that, the brains. I'll remember that and tell all my pilot friends that. No, it's an interesting, that's a big change from the first movie as well. When they have Maverick and Goose and a Tomcat, the Tomcat was a plane that was designed to have two people in it. You could not fly the aircraft without someone in the back seat. And with the F-18, that's not the case. So when they designed the F-18, there was single seat and two seat versions of them. And in fact, for the most part, most carrier air wings deploy with three single seat squadrons and one two seat squadron. Now, their argument can be made back and forth, for the rest of time if WISOs are necessary. But the way I've always heard and the way I've always experienced it firsthand is, if you have a really good WISO and a really good pilot, that team is just above and beyond. They can do they have so much situational awareness, or what we refer to as SA, in the cockpit, because you can have the pilot focusing very intently on, actually dogfighting, while I'm keeping lookout, seeing if there's anybody else behind us. And if our communication is in sync and, we're on the same wavelength, we can be a really, really powerful aircraft, as opposed to somebody that has to do all that themselves. Same thing goes for, air to ground mission. If we're the bombing runs, the FLIR tumbling every time they rolled in was pretty realistic. That was actually kind of funny when they yelled Deadeye. That just brought back memories. But weapon or sensor failure aside, the WISO can again really, really focus intently on finding the target, making sure the pilot can do everything, keep visual lookout, make sure it's, keeping the section safe, doing all those things that a pilot really needs to be focused on. That again is a very, very powerful duo. Where it, on the flip side, can be really difficult is if you have a pilot and or WISO combo that isn't in sync. Now you're detracting situational awareness. So now you're almost worse than the one. And you always, one plus one always has to equal two or more. That's the saying. It can't be less than two. So you cannot be the WISO in the back seat that's asking questions at the wrong time or isn't really aware, comfortable with what they should be doing. That's where, they can get a little bit of a bad reputation. But Bob's our hero. I think they did Bob well. They did WISO as well with Bob's character in the movie. He was hilarious. So, and one of the few, there were two call signs in the movie of people that I actually knew. I knew a Bob, and I knew a Rooster. So, real call signs there.
Okay, cool. Did you have a call sign?
I did. Mine was Cottle. Clear on the left. That's actually. I've got my helmet here so you can actually see that.
Oh, cool. That is so cool. Oh, that is great. That is awesome. Thank you for showing that. Now that's okay. Now let's take a pause right there, and let's fly away from the movie, no pun intended. But let's talk about you. Lieutenant Commander Ashley Pelzic, who served in the United States Navy for 11 years. I mean, you had a job that was not for the faint-hearted, let's be honest. You had a job that you had to go to countries like Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, and you had to drop bombs, you know? And you had to attack, you had to defend the United States, you had to defend other things. Tell us about that job.
Yeah, I would say, it's something that I felt a calling to. I joined the Navy because when I was a senior in high school, 9/11 occurred. So I was in that unique time frame where, there was a really, really big threat to our country. Domestically, here, and it's a rare occurrence. We hadn't had a lot of threats or attacks that had actually taken place on our homeland. And so, for me as a 17-year-old. But lived between New York and Boston and was pretty affected by the Twin Towers and the 9/11 occurrence. It really called me to serve, and I don't know that I would have had that same calling had I lived 5 years later or 5 years earlier. And so for me, it was a long buildup to those in-country deployments. I went through 2.5 years of flight school after graduation, then I went through 2 years of training in my squadron. So by the time I got to my first deployment, it was about 5 years after I graduated from the Naval Academy. So I actually felt very prepared. This was something I wanted to do. It was something I felt that we were on the right side of history for. The time I spent overseas, both in 2011 and 2017, when I deployed again in Syria and, as you mentioned, Iraq, that the it changed the landscape had changed a lot. We went from flying over Afghanistan towards the end of the Operation Enduring Freedom in 2011. And then to see what was happening with ISIS in Syria was a whole different war, even though it didn't seem that way to most people at home who didn't hear much about it or who didn't really know what was going on. Because the thing that'll always stick with me is just what was happening to, people on the ground, innocent civilians on the ground, and not being looked after by their own governments. And we take that for granted, I think, here in the States and elsewhere abroad sometimes, that we have it really good. And having been exposed to a place that few people in the world have ever seen and few people have had to encounter is very, very, it's very humbling, but it's also very harrowing. And so I think just having, it's not an easy job, as you mentioned. It's not for the faint of heart, and it's not something you take lightly. You come back every day and you sort of shake off that flight and go about your business because you believe in your heart it's the right thing to do, but it's definitely not an easy job.
Did you have any psychological scars when you first started doing that? I mean, at the end of the day, it's not your choice to fire. It's someone from the higher up telling you permission to launch, permission to fire.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I was very fortunate. I think the missions I was involved in were all very well thought out. We have very good training. We knew what we should do, what we shouldn't do, what to avoid. For example, in the instance that civilians happen to, either walk in or be, somewhere near one of your targets and you can no longer employ because it's just, you can't employ on innocent civilians. Those things, I was lucky. I was involved in a lot of missions that were executed very, correctly. I have friends that were either involved in situations where the intelligence maybe wasn't fully there when they launched, and the target that they attacked maybe wasn't the right, not necessarily not the right target, but had innocent people nearby that, ended up being a byproduct of the effects of the mission. And that's, I know they've really struggled with that, and I know they think back on their time in the military and question some of, what we were doing over there. And I mean, I think that's for everybody to sort of figure out on their own. But I was lucky. I mean, coming home from deployment's always a bit of a weird thing. You're used to being, 7 to 9 months on a carrier. You wake up, you do the same thing every day. You see the same people every day. You're very close with all of your squadron mates, and you're involved in very, very heavy, serious stuff. And you're excited to get home, and you think everything's going to be wonderful. And you get home, and you realize, wow, nobody knows what's going on over there. Nobody really cares. Everyone's complaining about things that don't matter. Where's their perspective? And it takes you a bit of adjustment time. That's, I think, one of the harder parts. Not so much scars for me, just more so readapting or, getting back into the normal environment, the day to day. That was tough for me. It always took a couple of months.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And I'll just ask one more question on that note. And then after that, I'll ask some other questions about you yourself, individually. But was this, I remember, obviously, you're talking to a big Hollywood buff. in terms of war movies and American movies. So my knowledge of wars are very historical from the books and very superficial from the movies. But I remember Bradley Cooper once said in an American Sniper movie, when I think he was talking to a very, I can't remember her name, a very popular, good-looking actress in the movie. They were like, he was hitting on her, and he said, "Oh, you're just a typical soldier, blah blah blah. You're gonna do this, you're gonna do that." And then he turned around and said something quite authoritative. He said, "Look, I don't see what's the problem." He said, "This is the United States of America. This is a great country. I want to defend it." What does that statement mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sums it up fairly perfectly. I think I believe very deeply that, we're in a country where we have, beyond basic human rights for most people. I think we could do a better job, but I think, if you compare to most places in the world, we've got it pretty good here. I've grown up with very, very dedicated parents and in a wonderful family, and they've gone on to have their own wonderful families. So I feel almost compelled to protect and defend, the life that we have here and the life that we've all been able to build. And if that meant, serving for about 11 years, then, that was the right thing for me to do. It's not for everybody. I do get that too. But I loved it. I mean, it set me up for so many opportunities and the best of friendships and a lot of hard times. I mean, another thing I left out that's really accurate in the movie is, I've lost a lot of friends in aviation act in various military mishaps. In my class alone at the Naval Academy, I think we've lost eight classmates. And then throughout my military flying career, I've lost about, I think last time I counted, it was 18 friends in aviation related mishaps. And I think Maverick says it, and I think it's said in the first movie, and I think Maverick says it, in the second movie as well, after his mentor says it in the first, is something about, if you live long enough, you're lucky you haven't lost anyone yet. If you live long enough in this business, you will. Something along those lines. And it's, I remember hearing that in flight school. So they tell you that day one, like, look around the room, in 10 years, one or two of you based on percentages won't be here. That's how dangerous this job is. So again, all of that, wrapped back up to your main question. I think for me, I felt a calling to serve. I think some people are mission driven and mission oriented, and I feel strongly about, the service that I had in the country that I did it for. So.
And you did an outstanding job, 11 years in the Navy. That's amazing. And you've gone on to bigger and, I mean, other things, other great things. I mean, I'll speak about that in a minute. But was this, tell us about the culture of being a woman in the United States Navy and being a female pilot.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's changed. It's one of those things. I saw it when I, even starting off at the Naval Academy in 2002, there were, I think my class had around 16 or 17%, it was 16 or 17% female. I think we graduated around 10 or 11, so pretty small percentage. I think the classes now are up to 25, 30%. So there's so much change in such short periods of time. And I was a benef, you know, I was a somebody who benefited from just really, really positive change in the Navy. I had really positive experiences in flight school, and I think that's where it starts. I think if your first exposure to the community is negative and they don't give you a chance, I think that can really, really taint the rest of your career. So I was lucky to have really great classmates to kind of bond with, and we were friends all the way through. We saw each other in the fleet, we saw each other for years, we still see each other when we can. But the instructors I had treated me very well, and then that sort of snowballed in a positive way, up, almost uphill, where by the time I got to the fleet, I was welcomed with mostly open arms. And I think everyone has a hard time as a new guy. I don't think I was treated any differently when I had a hard day than my male colleagues or counterparts were. I think I was treated fairly. If anything, I almost think sometimes I had a little bit of an advantage. I think if you're a woman that joins the squadron and you do really well, it's not that you're not expected to, it's just that a lot of the commanding officers want to see that happen, and they want more women to join, so they feel this, feel compelled to help support your career. And that's what I had. I had tons of support. I mean, I had commanding officers that are, coming to my wedding, and people who supported me when I was transitioning out of the military, who really didn't have to. They could have said, "Oh, you're not staying in. All right, good luck in your next steps." But they set me up with people to talk to. They wrote me recommendation letters for grad school. I truly believe it's trending more and more positively. And when I look at squad, their squad, my old squadron now has five women in it. When I flew with them, it was a huge deal that we had three or four at a time, because my first time deploying, I was the only woman in the squadron and one of two F-18 aviators in the air wing out of about 80 people. So it's certainly getting better and better. And I'm personally grateful for my opportunity.
Now, I just got two more questions, Ashley. Now, in the movie Top Gun 2, Ed Harris said to Lieutenant Pete Mitchell, which is Tom Cruise, and said, "The end is inevitable, Maverick. Your generation or your time is extinct," because he was trying to replace, he is trying to replace technological pilots, I mean, robot pilots, to human pilots. So, and that's what you do for a living in Merlin Labs. So tell us about that. That's a bit of an oxymoron in life, right?
It is. It's funny. I mean, my joke is always when I talk to my military pilot friends that, hey, you guys shouldn't have been so mean to us wizzos, you know, now we're going to replace you. But all jokes aside, you know, I don't think we'll truly ever replace pilots. I think pilots are a very unique skill set and they're really imperative. I think one of the things that we're working on at Merlin is, you know, being able to first and foremost reduce crew on large aircraft, right? So not going necessarily from two pilots down to zero, but two down to one initially. And we're really focused on the cargo market as well as the military use case, because there's a lot of interest in, especially when we start thinking, you know, advanced near peer threat environments with some of those countries. You know, we have to think very strategically and we don't necessarily want to put a ton of people down in harm's way. And so if we can reduce the number of pilots or air crew that are required on aircraft, I think it's the right move. There's also massive pilot shortages you can read about. I mean, commercial side, military side, pilots are getting out in droves and they're not necessarily replacing themselves. So we're also fixing a problem on that end too, and allowing our military to stay lethal with fewer pilots and allowing the commercial cargo market to survive despite the massive shortfalls. So for me, I view it as both of a, you know, it's a utility piece, but it's also safety. And if you talk to any of the test pilots that are working at my company alongside me, we all got into this because of the safety aspect. I touched on it earlier. You know, I've lost a bunch of friends, mostly in accidents where it was pilot error. And the more we can do to automate systems and allow them to fly the aircraft and focus on what they need to safely fly, the better. And so I think that's all part of the technology that Merlin's bringing to the table, which is, it's a really exciting thing to work on. And it's been, I've been truly honored to be a part of the team there.
And amazing, absolutely amazing. And like, yeah, what goes around comes around, huh? Rizzo's ruled the world. But final question, Ashley, it's been a wonderful discussion and I felt really inspired by it. And I'm sure a lot of our viewers are being inspired by it. Some of them are asking questions now. And I know you're replying to it as well, but just basically final question, what's your sharing that you have for young women, for young boys who would probably look at Top Gun 2 and say, I want to be Lieutenant Pete Mitchell. I want to be those pilots in the air. I want to be like Phoenix and make a difference. And gender is not an obstacle. What's your advice in sharing to them?
My advice is just do it and don't listen to people that say you can't do it. You know, I remember even at the Naval Academy, people saying, oh, you haven't wanted to go here your whole life, you're not going to make it. And that's not true. You know, I actually think the opposite. If you've made these really important life decisions because you're really passionate about something, whether it's sports, whether it's flying an airplane or anything else you want to do, being president of the United States, I think we've had so much more representation and demonstrations of people that could do it. You know, we've seen Phoenix, obviously, in the movie is very representative of a lot of the women I worked with, and she's awesome. And I hope a lot of young women see that movie and decide that's what they want to do. I also think the second movie is super diverse generally, with the pilot representation. And I think the military could really stand to benefit from more diversity. And I know that's a big effort for them. And I hope this movie helps promote that. And I hope any kid that didn't picture themselves flying before they saw the movie sees someone that looks like them or acts like them or talks like them, you know, now thinks they can do it. So my message is just don't let anybody tell you can't do it.
No, I 100% concur with that advice. And I'm just going to support you with that advice. And forgive me, I'm going to apologize in advance to close the show if I'm sounding cheesy. But my favorite line from that movie is that I feel the need for speed. Anthony Edwards said that to Tom Cruise every time they flew, and that just gave you this adrenaline pumping. And I'm from sports, so that adrenaline pumping line can just pump you up in a matter of seconds. But Lieutenant Commander Ashley Pelzig, if you are evidence of anything, it is proof that you are an example of, you feel the need for speed, but the need for speed to help you lead so others can become much, much better. So on behalf of the whole world and all our viewers, thank you for being you. Well done on being you, and keep continuing the good stuff that you're doing in the industry, because you're definitely a game changer. And I say this to all our guests, anytime you want to come back to Great People TV to tell more great stories, whether it's Merlin Labs or whether it's Top Gun or whether it's anything cool and innovative you're doing, just send me a message. I'll put you back on there in a matter of seconds. The need for speed is very quick here on Great People TV.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, that's my favorite line too. So love it.
Thanks so much, Ashley. You take care. Yeah, and thanks for being you. Amazing interview. Thank you so much.